Hello, and welcome to part two of Islamic FinTech, the OnFuff podcast series. Today, I'm joined again by Abdul Hasib Basit, co-founder and principal of Ellipsis, and Umer Soliman, head of governance and Islamic FinTech at Yildiz. In this episode, we delve deeper into the market of Islamic FinTech and look at global Islamic FinTech hubs and regulatory environment. The uptake to digitalization in the Islamic finance world has been relatively slow in comparison to non-Muslim markets. However, this trend has changed over the last 2 years or so, and the number of Islamic fintech companies around the world has grown. Abdul, yourself first, and then Umer, if we get your thoughts as well. What factors do you think are driving this growth? Where do you see the main markets, and what are the main verticals or sectors within Islamic fintech that you see as key growth areas?
So much like conventional finance, after the 2007 and 8 financial crisis, a lot of people needed to look at alternative careers. Banks were making folks redundant. Add to that that since then we've seen changing economic environment in the GCC with declining oil prices and a changing demographic with more youth coming into the workforce or with less access to traditional government and corporate jobs. And all of this leads to a perfect storm where demand for entrepreneurial careers, the rise of technology, and really the sort of rethinking of the banking sector all come together. And so there is more of a move into building more entrepreneurial hubs in the GCC, and that's led to a lot of banks looking at how they can tap into some of that innovation outside of their own four walls. There is a bit of a time lag. I think the GCC and Islamic finance generally have been slightly late adopters, but it's pretty much trailing conventional finance with about a two-year time lag. The sectors that we've seen growing early on have really been around crowdfunding and peer-to-peer. They're areas of low regulatory friction. They're areas where consumers are underserved and areas where technology really brings a unit cost advantage. So where tech firms can really compete with traditional bricks and mortar banks on a cost basis. The big growth areas that we see going forward in the future are really challenger bank, really trying to disintermediate the core function of a bank, which is current account and payments. And then latterly, we'll start seeing more penetration in the cap markets and infrastructure space within banking as well.
Thanks, Abdul. And Umer, your thoughts. What do you think are the factors that are driving this growth in Islamic fintech over the last couple of years? As Abdul's mentioned, there seems to be a little bit of a lag, but you know, a lot of the sectors are catching up now. And so perhaps you could look at some of the main markets or different sectors that you see as potential growth areas as well.
Absolutely. I think generally, if you look at the digitization and in terms of technology, if you look at the Muslim majority markets, if we're looking at the GCC and Malaysia, there is a slight lag anyway. So when it comes to finance, they're going to be slightly behind the curve. And so when we discuss Islamic fintech, then there's going to be that slight lag there as well. The main factors driving the growth for now is, I think, number one, the opportunity. There's been a lot of challenge around conventional banking. And as the sort of millennial generation come through, they're looking for new opportunities. They're not tied to the brands as perhaps previous generations were. So a lot of the large banks, they don't have the same brand loyalty. And with technology, you've got ease of opportunity. They're a lot more connected now in terms of the digital world and with the social media. So they're seeing other opportunities that are out there and they're applying those same skills. And fintech is allowing them to take benefit from this. So they're taking what previously would have been conventional banking apparatus and thinking of ways that they can benefit from it. And they don't have the burdens that previous generations had in terms of what products they want to apply. So I think for me, looking at the market, we're going to see real growth again. In far as Malaysia has always been an interesting space in terms of Islamic finance, they've always been ahead of the curve. So I think we're going to see now they're already talking about products within blockchain, utilizing blockchain and cryptocurrency, which is slightly different to fintech, but it shows in the direction in which they're going. So we're going to see a lot of activity there. I think the GCC will do. From my experience of the GCC, I don't think we're going to see anything groundbreaking in terms of the type of products. I think we're just going to see rebranded products that we're seeing in the West. But I think the UK definitely is an interesting space. Number one, because of its position globally in terms of financial markets. Secondly, because of the technology expertise. And thirdly, because of the human capital that we have here, the expertise that we have here, and the want to change. Disruptive technology is huge now. And especially from the young Muslim millennials, they no longer feel tied in the same way to even the Islamic bank. So they want to have products that suit them, that are competing on price and quality. And they also have the experience. And now they've got access to the technology to be able to actualize a lot of these changes that they want. So for me, these are the main factors driving the growth. The main markets, I think, definitely Far East. And I think we'll see increasingly in Europe.
Thank you both. It's good that we've touched on the different markets, and in a bit I'd like to discuss these areas that could be so-called Islamic fintech hubs. In the meantime, we've touched on a few of the upsides and the opportunities of Islamic fintech, so I think it's only fair that we explore some of the challenges to the sector. One issue that has come up is the need to establish regulations and necessary supervision to ensure that fintech complies with Sharia law requirements. Umar, given your background, perhaps if you could go into this first, and then Abdul, do you think it's a fair criticism? And if so, what can be done to improve regulation and supervision of Islamic fintech, either here in the UK or in other markets?
I don't think it's a fair criticism, to be honest. Sharia law, the way it applies is that there's a plethora, there's a vast array of views within Islamic jurisprudence, and that actually benefits people who are entering this space. It doesn't necessitate that it has to be a particular view, and that actually gives freedom for people to innovate, to come up with solutions, to come up with new products and new technologies that can provide those solutions. And ultimately, the way it needs to be applied is as other compliance departments do, and policy. So it's not a question of strangling people with regulation. It's providing the guiding principles that sets the policy and then companies adopting those policies. So here in the UK, we've not had that issue. It's making sure that we're compliant with the FCA. And then the Sharia communities are there, and then you're able to adopt them as you need. And it's for the market to then dictate eventually whether they're happy with it or not. And I think increasingly we're going to see the market deciding and dictating which way the Sharia compliancy will go. Because as we've seen, Islamic finance has been around for around 30 to 40 years now. And they've been very stale in terms of the products that they've had. And there's been a bit of disillusionment with the current products that are available. Something like between 80 to 90% of the Islamic finance market is done with murabaha structures. And the younger generation, the new generation, are not entirely accepting of that. So we need to see policies that are coming out from the Sharia giving guidance on what's acceptable. And then the market will dictate, saying, well, look, we accept this and we don't accept X, Y, and Z. Hopefully this will see a convergence, I think now, of not just Sharia compliancy, but moving towards more ethical finance in terms of other factors such as SDG, like the UN Sustainable Development Goals. A lot of the people I speak to in the market, they want to see ethical products as well as those which are tick the box for in terms of Sharia compliancy. They want to see products which are good to the environment as well. So they will detect this. They will look, we want these type of products. And if they're coming in at the right price, that will help inform policy going forward around Islamic finance.
Thank you, Umar. Interesting that you brought up this idea that because of the different interpretations, a variety of views in Islamic law, it actually gives freedom to people to innovate. Abdul, do you have any thoughts on this?
I don't think I can add anything to Umar's views on Sharia compliance. I think they're spot on. I think the one area I'd like to address is regulation. And this is an area that, given the nature of the GCC market, it's been a long-standing desire from a lot of fintechs that are looking to access that market to have some regulatory clarity around how they can operate in the different jurisdictions. One of the real opportunities is really for the regulatory bodies to start collaborating. In the UK, the FCA here has been at the forefront of that, having set up something called Fintech Bridges a few years ago, which was bilateral collaboration across regulatory jurisdictions. Earlier this month, the Global Financial Innovation Network was launched, which has 12 regulatory bodies around the world joining on day one to start collaboration. And that includes ADGM, DFSA, and the Central Bank of Bahrain. So three GCC regulators from day one. And that's a huge step forward in that will start to bring about more regulatory clarity for fintechs on how to access that region. Predominantly what fintechs want is to access one geography and be able to scale from there. They don't want to have to go through burdensome compliance and cost of getting authorized in every single jurisdiction when they're accessing the GCC market. So that cross-border collaboration certainly helps. And I think really that's really where the GCC has the opportunity to build a scale market and also a scale market beyond the GCC. A lot of fintechs want to position themselves in the GCC for access to the Indian subcontinent, to North Africa, to wider Africa as well. And that really is, I believe, going to be the play for GCC territories for the next few years as it pertains to fintech.
There is a point there that you've mentioned of regulatory collaboration and cohesion, which, as you've rightly pointed out, is the FCA has been leading on that, and the Global Financial Innovators Network is the next step. So I'd actually like to then move on a little bit, this idea of what makes a good Islamic fintech hub. You know, as with fintech, there's competition between different jurisdictions to become this global Islamic fintech hub, or at least a key jurisdiction where companies want to establish themselves. London makes a strong claim as the number one hub, and part of that is due to the I think the regulatory environment that's been created here by the FCA, Bank of England and the PRA have a certainly strong competition, as you've both mentioned, from Malaysia and also the GCC. Abdul, perhaps yourself first and then Uma, what makes a good Islamic fintech hub to you? Obviously, I think regulation would be a key part of that, but what other factors are there? And in your opinion, is there a number one, or is this kind of spread across different areas? And where do you see as the next move for someone to push towards becoming this number one hub?
Well, there's three real pillars that define a hub, and those are capital, talent, and regulation. The UK has predominantly led on regulation, as we've discussed, and it is stronger on talent, given that we have a world-leading financial centre and a booming tech sector. And from the Islamic finance space, we have a really good set of professional services competencies in Islamic finance as well. The GCC and Malaysia, from an Islamic finance perspective, have significantly more capital than the UK. But I think this discussion about, you know, who's leading, I think it's always a fluid thing. I think on various aspects, some hubs are leading others. And I think what the job to be done is really to assess what are the gaps and really try and make progress on those. And I think this is where the GCC over the last 2 years has significantly made progress on upskilling their regulators and encouraging local talent into tech-led or entrepreneurial careers, especially into fintech. And there's been a lot of government support to set up infrastructure and programs to encourage that entrepreneurship. So, for example, in Bahrain, we've seen the launch of Bahrain Fintech Bay, which is a physical destination. In Dubai, we've had the DIFC Fintech Hive. ADGM have set up their Reg Lab, and the Dubai government has launched their blockchain initiative. So all of these signals show outside companies outside the region that there is a demand for their services in the region. And it also signals to the talent within the region that there's an opportunity to move into this space as well. We talked about some of the sort of regulatory collaboration as a gap, and that's being filled. I think the one thing that never really gets discussed is the capital that is available in the GCC currently isn't really being deployed outside of the GCC other than at the sovereign wealth level. So there's an opportunity here for investors to invest in technology wherever it's being built around the world. And I think that's really the USP of the Middle East, in that deep capital pools can be deployed around the world to invest in technology, learn from it, and attract it back to the region. And I don't think we've seen enough of that yet. And I think that's really an opportunity for the future.
So on what makes a good Islamic fintech hub, and I suppose for you, obviously, you can speak to your experience in the UK being the first Islamic fintech that went through the FCA's sandbox, and that's obviously been supportive. But are there other factors, you know, specifically looking at capital and also human talent, that you think might help? And for you, where would you see as leading fintech hubs in the world? Is it the GCC, as we've mentioned, because of deep capital pools? Is it Malaysia because of the market? Or is there something that we haven't actually mentioned yet?
I completely agree with what Abdul said, and I couldn't add anything further to that, especially in terms of the three pillars. I would say, I think another way of looking at where, well, rather than what makes a good Islamic fintech hub, I like to say where I'd like to see a good Islamic fintech hub would actually be in countries where there's the most need. And so if we look at Malaysia, for example, when we said before, they've got a mature market. We've got GCC, which has got a number of existing players in terms of conventional Islamic finance. And in the UK, we've got an emergence of Islamic fintech companies. But I think if we start looking at other regions, if we start looking at Africa, for example, if we start looking at the Indian subcontinent, where there's a need for products, and hopefully through fintech, we're going to be able to provide those products, then I think that's a real opportunity for an Islamic fintech hub to be established. Because if we're looking at the solutions that it offers and work backwards, then where is the most need for those type of products, and what is the type of need? So in the UK, we've seen that the Muslim community has required genuine Islamic investment products. And the issue now is going to be, I think, around home ownership, genuine ways of finding home ownership outside of the existing Islamic finance operators. In Malaysia, they already have a number of Islamic finance providers. So you're thinking, well, what products and what solutions are the fintechs providing there above and beyond what's already there? And I think the markets and the requirements, again, Africa, even some continent, these type of countries, their basic requirements and basic amenities and services can be provided through fintech. So I'd like to see a world-class Islamic fintech hub in one of these countries. Undoubtedly, you're going to have them in GCC. Again, you've got mature regulation, you've got the access to capital to help innovate, etc. But I think it's going to be stagnant. They're going to be showpiece products that we have. So if we're talking about things like mobile banking, we're talking about microfinancing, all of these things can be facilitated through digitization and Islamic fintech. And I'd like to see an Islamic fintech hub in one of these places, obviously with the help of the mature markets. The UK, as I've spoken on one of the other questions, definitely has the ability to be world-class class, and it probably is at the moment one of the top Islamic fintech hubs. We've got the FCA providing their sandbox opportunities, the regulation, and we've got competition. This is the other thing that we have here, is real competition in many different ways that the Islamic fintech companies are able to benefit from and push themselves further with. And we haven't seen that as much in some of the other markets we spoke about, like GCC and the Far East.
So one thing Umar picked up on is the UK's role in that. And I think that's a really important thing for us to talk about, given that we are currently UK-based and we operate within the Islamic finance and fintech space in the UK. The UK is really seen as a neutral venue by a lot of Islamic finance institutions and countries. Where you have a solution built in the UK, it's seen as being applicable to every jurisdiction. And whilst geographically we might be removed from some of those locations that Umar was talking about, like the Far East, where there's real need for Islamic finance solutions and there's huge underserved population, the UK really represents a great testbed. And I think that's how it should really be seen from an Islamic fintech perspective, in that we have, as we've discussed, the pillars that make a great hub here, perhaps lacking in capital, but that's starting to change. But it's really a great place to start your business, get into a test market of over 1 million Muslims here in the UK that require Islamic finance services, and then scale it from here to other parts of Europe and to those locations that Umar is talking about. So whilst we're waiting for those hubs to emerge in other places where they're really needed and on all of the support that goes alongside that, the UK still has a real role to play in that time frame and helping other fintech firms to emerge here and scale globally.
Just sticking with the UK, has been a bit of criticism from some people that the UK's potential is inhibited by a lack of penetration by Islamic banks for Islamic capital. So Abdul, you mentioned that the GCC, that's one of their strong points, whereas in the UK, really, it's sort of regulation and talent. But the Bank of England have plans to offer a post-Sharia compliant liquidity tool to a wider range of financial institutions beyond Islamic banks to boost demand. Do you think that's a potential solution? And what more could be done to address that lack of capital?
I think the Bank of England liquidity tool, as they've proposed to launch, is a step in the right direction. I think it's still in the design phase, and it will eventually make the UK more attractive place for Islamic banks. But I think there is a need for greater infrastructure than just that in the UK. From a fintech perspective, I don't think a huge amount of fintechs will really benefit from that. There may be a few that require lending capital that might be able to use the treasury solution that the Bank of England is proposing. But I think where we're really missing a trick in the UK is having funds or something akin to a fund that will invest in Sharia compliant tech solutions. This is a topic that's been discussed at length at the UK Islamic Fintech panel. Firms like Yielders, who've raised funding rounds, have found it difficult to do so because they're seen as niche and traditional investors don't really see the mass market appeal of it, even though there is a mass market appeal of most Islamic fintech solutions. So having more what I would call aligned investor or more of an aligned investment infrastructure is something that really needs to be developed. I think the Bank of England solution is a step towards that, but I think there's significantly more to be done in that space. Ideally, what we'd like to see is a significant size fund that can invest in not only Islamic fintech, but all halal economy products coming out of the UK, because there is a real entrepreneurial environment here that is building those solutions, but it's certainly slowed down by the lack of investment capital available.
As Umar, as someone who's gone through the experience of fundraising in a UK Islamic fintech, do you think that there is a need for more specific funds or capital? And Abdul touched on this point that some investors might not see the mass market appeal, but as we've discussed, really, if you look at it more from a kind of ESG perspective and lens, there could be investors who would find this more of an attractive investment or be more willing to be involved in looking at Sharia compliant companies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I completely agree with Abdul's points on this and welcome the Bank of England's proposal. The challenge has been for Islamic finance in the UK. Over the years, there's been a number of initiatives and a number of gestures, and few have really settled and materialized long term. And I think now is the time that support needs to come in. Setting up the fund, it's on the cusp. This is, you know, the tipping point potentially. If the funds come in with the talent that's here, it will certainly open up and accelerate innovation and the product stuff that are potentially available. If such a fund had been available, I mean, I know I speak to many different entrepreneurs, many of them looking for access to Sharia compliant financing, and it's just not available. You would have seen, I think Yielders is one that, purely due to the hard work of the founders, it's pushed its way through. But there's many others who would have come through, but because they didn't have access to the financing, they weren't able to take it any further. So that's the point we would like to see more. This is, we welcome the Bank of England's initiative, but I think we really do need to see more in this space. In terms of opening it up to potentially other investors and non-Muslims, it's a double-edged sword with Islamic finance and Sharia compliancy, because it's, to be very frank, it's become a bit of a loaded term. And depending on who you're interacting with, Sharia either works for you or against you. And so this is something I think the industry has been thinking about. We're moving more towards ESG and ethical branding, but at the same time, the halal stamp, so to speak, has its weight. And I think the general finance market is becoming more mature. And I think people are looking at more of these initiatives where actually it's not just about your dollar return, but about the social return. And Islamic finance itself, in this new iteration of it, people are more aware of that. They're making sure that the products they bring are not just Sharia compliant, but Sharia based and meet the spirit of the Sharia, Maqasid of Sharia, and what they do, which should automatically neatly align with any of these SDG or ESG goals that other investors would have. And we're at that point now where investors are becoming more mature about this, and people developing the products are understanding this, and they're showcasing how the two resonate with each other as well as being aligned.
Thank you. We've talked about the investors, and guys, I just think I'd like to move on to sort of the last few questions. So FinTech opens up possibilities that Islamic finance industry can benefit from enhancing its client services competitiveness compared to conventional lenders. We've touched on the different areas where that might happen. And we also discussed the idea of non-Muslim investors being involved. And you said a Sharia can be a double-edged sword. But do you think that FinTech will help increase the market share of non-Muslims using Islamic financial services? What are the sort of barriers to entry for that? What needs to be done both from the Islamic fintech community and wider beyond that? And what do you think that non-Muslim fintech companies can learn from the Islamic fintech market? Do you see room for greater collaboration?
Certainly, there is an opportunity to grow market share in the non-Muslim community, especially in the context of ethical, sustainable finance, as we've discussed. The question is around marketing and positioning for mass market. So a lot of the Islamic banks in the past few years have rebranded and tried to access more non-Muslim consumers, as well as getting greater penetration within the Muslim market as well. If you look at most Islamic finance solutions in the UK, I think somewhere around 30% of their customer base tends to be non-Muslim. So it's already significant, and it can grow further. In terms of the barriers to that, I think populism and general sentiment around Islam right now can be a barrier, as Umar mentioned. So really that positioning becomes even more important. But I think there is an opportunity to provide solutions for a greater clientele and be more inclusive for traditional banks to partner with firms who have more Islamic finance solutions. I think open banking will really make this easier in the future through APIs. So banks can really just plug in Islamic finance, Islamic fintech solutions and offer those services to their existing client base. And I think that will be a game changer for Islamic fintechs as well, in that they can access a broader market than the current challenge they have, which is access a Muslim market who are not served, so don't traditionally look for these types of products. With fintechs, they have to go through a huge education exercise. There is then a level of skepticism amongst Islamic finance consumers, given that they've been burnt in previous iterations around really the Sharia compliance of some of these products. But as Umar mentioned earlier, there is a real need for basic Islamic finance solutions like savings and investments that are not available to traditional Muslim consumers. So I think as that competition grows, as the market grows, and as more Muslim consumers start to benefit from those, I think by proving that model and proving that model works, it will actually start to penetrate more of the mass market as well. So I think firms have to really go after both markets and not just pigeonhole themselves in one, for the reasons we've discussed, that if you're too niche, then it can create challenges around funding and your positioning within the market as well.
Interestingly, I think it works both ways, actually, and I've seen this more recently as well. With the rise of products, I firmly believe if you're producing a premium product, quality product hitting the markers in terms of return, then it will be attractive. And if you have the right branding behind it, as Abdul mentioned, we don't operate in a vacuum. We are subject to the political situation of the day and our environment. So as it becomes more of an opposition to Islam and Muslims, then there is going to obviously be a fallout and then an adverse impact on Islamically branded products. But at the same time, we've also seen people looking past that. So our own experience with Yielders is that whilst it's not overtly branded as Sharia compliant, it very clearly is Sharia compliant. And you can see within some of the branding that it would appeal to Muslims. But we've had a number of non-Muslims who've invested with us and are interested in the product, who come to our workshops, etc., because the basic product hits the right markers from every perspective that they're looking at. Why I was saying it works both ways is because I've also now started to see non-Muslim financial services providers who are providing products that actually meet the goals of the Sharia. And what this means is that actually, well, for Muslims, well, it can have to be branded Sharia compliant. If it meets the principles and it is compliant, then they will go that way as well. And so what we want to see is healthy competition. And as an entire ecosystem, I'm happy that it's not just Islamic finance. I want to see the whole ecosystem, the whole financial system behaving better and moving towards a more equitable and just way of doing business. And so I think both industries can learn from each other and improve and ultimately provide better solutions to the society at large. So Islamic fintechs, definitely, I think once people start to understand that, well, they're providing a service and it's a principles-based manner, and they're based on solid foundations in terms of ESGs, and they just happen to be Sharia compliant, then there'll be a higher uptake of them. In terms of the barriers to entry into non-Muslim markets, and I think we've mentioned this before, at the end of the day, it's the politics of the day. If we can get past that, then it's a level playing field.
Thank you. That was a fascinating discussion about the market, the dynamics, the pillars that underpin global Islamic fintech hubs, the competition, and where you see the next developments. This was an interesting discussion, I'm sure, for all of our listeners, including those regulators out there. Next week's podcast asks the question, SRI and green sukuks, and that is with Michael Gifty, President of Gulf Bonds and Sukuk Association, and Maya Marissa Malik, Managing Director of Amini Advisors. This will be available on the OnFIF channel on Tuesday, so you can download it once it's been broadcast, or subscribe to our channel. If you've enjoyed the program, then please do leave us a review or comment via social media.